believe, brothers. First off, let's go back and see what we've had so far. We'll not try to review all of them. But what is the laws of teaching? That there are certain laws that apply to transferring information from our minds to the minds of others, just like there are laws of nature, like the law of gravity or other certain laws like that, that we have to live in harmony with if we're going to be able to influence people and influence their thinking. Okay? And the very first one was the law of the teacher. What is the law of the teacher? The teacher has to know what he's teaching. Now that sounds simplistic. It sounds like a truism. But it's more complex than that. In other words, a teacher must know by experience the lesson that he would teach. He has to have an experiential knowledge of what he would communicate to others. If it's just an academic subject, then all he is a reader. He's not a teacher. If he's just reading something out of a book to other people, it's not going to have the same kind of influence as it will if he knows what he's teaching. So if we're going to teach somebody else something, we have to know it by experience. Now, apply that to child rearing and soul winning as we're talking about it. What was the next law? After the law of the teacher, we had the law of the learner. What does the law of the learner say? He's got to pay attention. The law of the learner. The learner must attend with interest the material to be taught. In other words, he has to invest his effort or pay attention. And it's going to cost him something. And we talked about the various levels of attention, where you are first in passive attention, where you're caught up with every butterfly that flies by, and then you work at it and concentrate on it, and then eventually you become caught up in the material that you're concentrating on, and you're almost back in the passive attention mode, okay? And then the third lesson was the law of what? The teacher, the learner, and the third one was?
Language.
The language, all right? The law of the language. And what do we say about the law, about the language? What's the law? It has to be common to both the teacher and the learner. The language has to be common to both the teacher and the learner. Now, what that means is we must communicate in language or words that has the same meaning to the learner as it does to the teacher. Now, again, that sounds simplistic. But have you ever used words in trying to communicate the gospel to somebody that had a different meaning to you than they did to the person you were talking to? Anybody ever do that? Besides me? Okay, sure. You've got to stop and define your terms a lot of times. So we've got to communicate in language that is common to the learner in the same way that it is to the teacher. What was the fourth lesson? Teacher, learner, language,
lesson.
That's right. Yeah, the first one was the introduction, wasn't it? Okay, all right. So the law of the lesson. Now, what is a lesson? What does the law of the lesson say? You've got to pick up new information based on what you already know. If somebody teaches you something that is completely unrelated to what you already know, what will happen?
You won't understand it.
It'll go right over your head. Okay? Go right over your head. If somebody teaches you something that you've heard many, many times, what'll happen? You'll get bored. You'll go to sleep. Okay? So, a lesson that you're going to communicate to somebody has to be related to what you already know, but it has to take you further than where you already are. Now, you know, I want to relate this to what we're teaching on the radio right now. We're going through the life of Christ on the radio and have been for over a year. And this week we're going to be in the last part of John chapter 9 and the first 21 or so verses of John chapter 10. I'm not going to read all these verses, but I'd like to relate them together as we talk about today's lesson and how we can relate the information that we're learning to what we already know. This takes place in the last half, or actually the last quarter, of the third year of our Lord's ministry. So it's very near the end of his public ministry, very near the end of his life here on earth, okay? And he has just healed the blind man. And the discussion about that healing of the blind man has led him into a conflict with the Pharisees. Remember that? And the blind man was called before the Pharisees, and they're trying to find some information with which to indict Jesus so they can put him on trial and charge him with blasphemy. And we know this man's a sinner. Tell us what he did. And the fellow gives a tremendous testimony. Whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. But this one thing I know, whereas I was blind, now I can see. And then they go on and come back and say, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he comes back and he preaches to these preachers. And said, now this is a good thing here. Here you fellows are supposed to know all about truth. You're supposed to know all about the Word of God. You're supposed to know all about God. And you can't even explain this fellow here that gave me my sight. That's a great thing. What do you want? You want to believe in him too? And so they threw him out of the synagogue. They got real mad at him. And so, you know, that's not a story there of the church excommunicating a man. That's a story of a man excommunicating the church is what it is. He just threw them out of his life. And that's a good thing for him to do. As soon as that happened, the Lord starts teaching in the parable of the Good Shepherd. And it is related, and he's illustrating this idea of blindness. We know that's true. Look at verse 21 of chapter 10. He says, "Others said, these are not the words of him that hath the devil. And then they said, can a devil open the eyes of the blind?" So he teaches the parable of the Good Shepherd to illustrate what he's going to say about blindness. Okay? Look at the end of verse 9, or chapter 9. In verse 39, Jesus said, "For judgment I am come into this world, that they which see might not see, and that they which see might be made blind." That sounds like double talk to an unbeliever, doesn't it? He said, "Now, if you got your sight, I'm going to make you blind. If you're blind, I'll give you your sight." What's he saying? He said, say again. That's true. All right. In other words, actually, what he says is, I'm not only not going to reveal truth to you, I'm going to confuse you further unless you're willing to believe the truth. I'm going to make it harder for you if you're going to make it hard on yourself. He said, if you'll learn what I've already said to you, I'll give you more truth. Truth learned must be based on truth already known. Notice what he says. "Some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said to him, are we blind also?" In other words, you're an absurd person. We're not blind. And look what he says. "If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But because ye say, we see, therefore your sin remaineth." Now what's he saying? If you had enough sense and enough honesty to admit what you are, you could learn more truth. But because you deny what you are, you're not going to learn a thing. Isn't that what he's saying? A person who is willing to acknowledge that he's a sinner can learn how to get out of his sin. But a person who denies what he ought to know, if he'd be honest with himself, is not going to learn anything else. And then he goes on to give the parable to the Good Shepherd. And you know what he says in the parable to the Good Shepherd? "I'm the Good Shepherd. The sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life." In other words, those who know God, who already know who God is and what God requires of men, they're going to recognize me. They're going to recognize my voice. When I speak to them, they're going to know what I'm saying. They're going to learn because they're basing it on truth that they already know. What was he saying to the Pharisees? You think you know truth, but you don't know truth. You think you know God, but you don't already know God. They were seeking to control God. Notice what he says down here. Verse 12 of chapter 10. "He that is an hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming and leaveth the sheep and fleeth, and the wolf catcheth them and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth because he is an hireling and careth not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd and know the sheep and have known of mine." What's he saying? People who are in the ministry, they're getting away out there. Okay. People who are in the ministry for the money, or who are seeking to influence others for their own benefit, they're not really going to be concerned about others. There's only two methods of salvation. If you teach somebody that they're saved in the right way, in the Bible way, then they will trust Jesus Christ and have eternal life. The only other thing you can teach a person is to trust themselves or to trust you, and then they'll be lost. You see? And basically, if you teach somebody to trust anything other than Jesus Christ, what are you teaching them? To trust you. Isn't that right? He's saying, well, trust me. And this hireling is saying, well, you trust me, follow me. And then when the wolf comes, he not only is not going to be able to protect the sheep from the wolf, he can't protect himself from the wolf. Okay, so he'll have to run. So he doesn't know anything. And this whole lesson here in the parable of the Good Shepherd is a story based on this principle that we're teaching this morning. You can't learn truth unless you base it on truth that you already know. You've got to know a few things in order to learn something else. Okay? That's sort of like credit, isn't it? You ever heard that? You know, young couples complain about that a lot. Well, you know, you can't get credit unless you got credit. You ought to be glad about that. Okay? I'm telling the fellas in the budget committee the other day, there's only two people, only two reasons why you can't get credit. That's because they know you or they don't know you. Okay? That's one of those two reasons. But, you know, a lot of times, you've got to base your future progress on your past experiences. Isn't that right? All right, now that's what we've been learning so far in the law of the lesson. If we're going to teach somebody something, we've got to relate it to what they had before. Now that is so important. And if we would take that principle and apply it in the use of gospel literature or presentation of the gospel, it would go so far toward helping us. One of the best methods that I know of to help win a person that you don't know to the Lord is whenever you see them, give them a piece of gospel literature that builds on the one that you gave them last time. Pick out maybe half a dozen gospel tracts that take somebody through a series of lessons. One on the new birth, one on making a decision, or something like that. In other words, pick up a few pieces of gospel literature that will build. Or maybe copy some articles out of a magazine, or get a discipleship book or something like that, just copy those down. And give the first one to them. And then come back and give them another one. Come back and give them another one. I was involved in an evangelism outreach program when we were in Myrtle Beach that did that. We would take four different gospel tracts, and each one of them built on the lesson of the previous one. And all we did is we'd go by and we'd knock on people's doors, and we would give them the first tract. And say, we're from Calvary Bible Church. It was at the time. It's Calvary Baptist Church now. We'd like to leave this with you, and we'll come back and see you again. Love to have you come be with us in our services. And these were houses where we knew we weren't going to have much opportunity to get into the door. We'd leave the literature with them. We'd come back the next week, knock on the door, give them another piece. Come back the next week, give them another piece. By the time we got there, the third or fourth time, we had people asking us questions. We knew where they were. They either wanted to hear more or they didn't want us there. But we just, you know, continue to build one lesson based on another. I think that's an interesting and sometimes very effective method. Is that me doing that? Okay. Here? Oh, okay. Sorry. Did I bump the mic? All right, good. I thought something was broke. All right, let's take a look at the lesson that we saw last week, or that you all saw. By the way, appreciate your prayers for us last week. Had one of the most interesting experiences last week. The pastor of this church, Marvin Wood is his name, is a good fellow. I've been seeking to encourage him for 10 years, I suppose. He graduated from Lynchburg, Jerry Falwell School. But he's a good man, and he has a good balance, and he's a teachable fellow, and he listens, and I have been working with him. He's been a real help to us. Now, if there's anybody here from Jerry Falwell School, I'm not trying to be insulting, okay? But any of you working up there, or, you know, if the president of a school is here or there, anything like that. But all I'm saying is that most folks in Greenville understand what I'm talking about. But at any rate, that's one of those other schools, you know. But at any rate, he's a good man. And he was needing some time away, and he wanted to call some people that he trusted to come and cover things for him. And so we took a little mini vacation, sort of one of those preaching vacations like we do, you know. And we went up to the Wilds on Friday night and stayed up there and relaxed a bit. And then we picked Daniel up from camp on Saturday and then drove on down to Charleston. And we spent Saturday evening and all day Sunday there and then most of Monday and then came home and had a little time of refreshing there. And it was a real joy. We got to see Jerry Milburn. He was down there for reserves on Sunday. The boys and I went out onto Charleston Air Force Base, and he took us out on one of the big 141s, and we climbed all through that, and that was a lot of fun, and had a great time. But this church, it's a good church. It's a very transient church, a lot of military people in that church. And this is certainly not a reflection on Marvin, because I love him and his church, but I've been there three or four times over the years. Whenever we're down there, usually I'll try to visit with him. And there's always a different congregation because of the fact that there's so many military people there, and the transition is there. There's probably half a dozen core people that are always there, and everybody else is new. And I noticed that the level of intensity that we enjoy here in our church, and I say enjoy because I mean that, the level of intensity and accountability is something that you don't see in every church that you go to. Did you know that? And we didn't see it there. And so, you know, it was real hard. I mean, everybody was a little standoffish, a little bit, you know, preach to me, but don't mess with me, kind of an attitude. So I just thought, well, you know, I just don't believe in it. I'm just going to mess with you. Okay, so we did, you know. But we kind of broke a few things loose, I hope. And by the evening, I taught Sunday school and then the morning service, the evening service. And by the evening service, we had a good invitation and a good response. And it was a real blessing. But I need to pray for the folks down there. A lot of times it's hard to labor in a place where you have a lot of transients like that, a lot of turnover and people are only there for a year or two, and they know they're going to be gone in a year or two, and they just don't get real involved, you know what I mean? And so he's got a real hard thing going there, but he's right next to the Air Force base. But I tell you, I really thank the Lord for you people while I was down there, and thinking, boy, I don't know, something I have to give. I pastored here. I preach them out of here. They preach me out of here. One of the two. I don't know. We'd have to break this thing up. One of the two. But you know, when you get among a group of people that are a little bit, and again, don't misunderstand me. But you know, when you see them, they got this. Go ahead, bless me. I dare you. You know, kind of an attitude. You think, good night. So I thank God for you folks, and I know that whenever I bring guest speakers in here, they always remark on your responsiveness. So you keep that up, okay? And be teachable. And this this material that we're having here, I think, is one of the reasons that that you do that. We are trying to build on the things that you already know. All right. If we're to set the learner at the task of real thinking and the solution of real problems, we must define the process of thinking. Now, what are we talking about? We're talking about influencing people's minds. And the purpose of the lesson is to get people to do what? Huh? Are you out there? Respond. That's part of, yeah, okay. I'm looking for another word. I'm looking for another word. It's related to this word. It's similar. Think. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So, get people to think. To think. And Charles Tremendous Jones, you know who he is?
Yeah.
Tremendous Jones. He says, you know, you announce he's coming and people don't know whether they're coming to hear a wrestler or a cleanser. But at any rate, they call him Tremendous Jones because every time somebody says something to him, he always says, tremendous. That's tremendous. You know, I just got a promotion. That's tremendous, you know. And we just had a new baby. That's tremendous, you know. Just wrecked my car. That's tremendous. Everything he said, that's tremendous. But so they started calling him Tremendous Jones. But he says that people are always telling you, you don't listen. He said, but that's not the problem. Thinking is the problem. Think. You don't think. And if we get people to think, well, then they're really listening. Because it's possible to act like or look like you're listening without thinking. And in lessons, when we're concentrating on communicating something to a person, thinking is what we want them to do. That's why I like to have eye contact with my children when I'm trying to talk to them. And I constantly hear myself saying, look at my face, look at my face. You do that to your kids? Hey, look at me, up here. I want to know that they're thinking. I want to be able to look into those eyes and make sure they're in there. Okay? Because sometimes they can be doing all the right things as far as sitting still and not talking, but they're not hearing a word you're saying. Sometimes they'll be looking right at you and not hearing a word you're saying. Okay? But you can usually tell if you got them when you're looking in their eyes. You want them to be thinking with you and learning from you. And a lot of times when folks are presenting the gospel, I don't think sometimes that they think about whether the other person is thinking. They don't ask questions. You go out with your four-point plan and you have the attitude sometimes, you be quiet while I get through this because your blood is on my hands and I got to get it off. In other words, is that the reason that we're going? Is that what we're trying to do? Suppose you ask somebody a question. Have you ever gone to all the way down to the point of a decision, asking the person to receive Christ, and they still don't realize they're a sinner? You didn't teach that good enough? And you ask them to make a decision for Christ, and they won't, and you wonder why, and they say, well, you know, I just think, you know, if you do the best you can, and now you got to go all the way back to point one, and you never should have left point one, but you didn't know it because you didn't ask questions. Right? You didn't relate to the person and you didn't ask them what they were understanding. Okay, so the first, there's a stage of doubt or uncertainty. That's where they don't know, they don't understand. That's where most people are concerning the gospel today. Second, there's an organizing stage in which the individual considers the means at his disposal to reach the ends desired. In other words, well, what's available for me to learn this? How am I going to figure this out? Let's take a look at it. What is here? You know, when you got this handout, you started looking through it to see if there's anything in here that you cared about learning or that interested you or that might in some way help you or that looks familiar and so on. And then lastly, there's the critical attitude involving selection and rejection of the schemes which have suggested themselves. Well, I think that'll help me, but I don't think this is any good. And I think this will help. No, I'll do away with that. Do you read that way? When you pick up a book to decide if you want to read it, do you flip through and see if there's anything in there that interests you? Isn't that the way you do it? All right. So, number 13 then says, in a very important sense, what we call knowledge is a record of solved problems. Now, you've heard me preach that before, haven't I? Know my illustration that I use about learning in math when you're a kid? You go to school to learn math, and what do? What do they give you? They give you problems, and they send you home with those problems, and you have to work those problems out. And we call them what? Problems. It is a problem. And you have to figure out how to solve those problems. And in the course of solving those problems, what are you learning? How to think. How to reason. The purpose of learning mathematics is not just so that you can add and subtract and divide and multiply. It's so that you can learn to think logically. So that you can learn to reason. And solving math problems is one illustration of solving problems in life. Isn't that right? Now, God teaches us exactly the same way. People come to me and they say, well, Pastor, I just got so many problems. Thank God. You're in school. God's got you in school. Will you pray for me that I'll be able to solve all my problems? No, I will not. I'm going to pray that you keep learning from your problems. Pray for me that I'll get rid of all my problems so I can get on with my life. Friend, you misunderstood life. If you are thinking that you will be happy when you get all your problems behind you, you're mistaken. I didn't do that time. You understand what I'm saying? The way that you get progress in life is by getting new problems. It's like the one guy said, you know, if you come to me and say, well, you know, pray for my problem. Yeah, I'm going to pray for your problem. Pray you get rid of that one and get you a real one. Okay? So you can learn. Isn't that right? Give you a project. Kids come to me, Dad, will you do this for me? If it's something I know they cannot do, I'll maybe help them. But if it's something that I know they ought to do but they don't want to do, I don't help them. No, you do that. Oh, I can't. We'll figure it out. You see, sometimes you get to find out whether you really care or not if the problem is serious enough. Isn't that right? And what you know by experience because you have worked your way through it. You have worked your way out of those problems. So what we do when we give a lesson to somebody else is we introduce a certain amount of problems to them. Now, you know what we as fundamental Christians do sometimes when we're trying to communicate truth to people? Instead of giving people problems or projects to work on, what do? Yeah, we solve their problems for them. Instead of giving a lesson, what do we give?
A lecture,
answers. What does that teach people to do? Depend on you. That's one thing. What else does it teach them?
To do nothing.
Teach them to do nothing. It also teaches them that you think you know everything, and they don't know anything and never will. Isn't that right? Have you ever met anybody that believes that we think we know it all?
What? Many times they will misunderstand our motives, that we think we're so much better.
Yeah, we think we're better than they are. Why do you suppose that those that we are trying to tell about Christ, why do you think that sometimes they think we think we're better than they are? Yeah. Yeah, what's the way we communicate to them? In other words, sometimes we give the impression, okay, now look, you dummy, listen to me, because I know all the answers, and if you will listen, then you will know what I know, and then you can be like me. And then they say, no, thank you. Okay? Isn't that right?
Also, in the area of separation, some sinner that is not a Christian even yet will think that we're trying to make them conform to a certain image.
Yeah. That's right.
We think we're above them.
That's right. All right. He's using the illustration of separation. A lot of people who don't know the Lord or don't understand Bible principles, when they hear us talking about separation, they start thinking about who knows what. I mean, if you go up to the average person and say, well, I believe in separation, what are they going to think? Well, you and your wife not getting along?
I can't do anything I like anymore.
Can't do anything I like anymore? You mean I can't do this, and I can't do that, and I can't do this, and I can't... Is that what I got to do to be a Christian? Is that what separation is? What does the average person think we mean when we use the word separation today? Yes? Yeah, we don't care about others. You mean you're not ecumenical? No, I'm not ecumenical. I am pluralistic. There's a difference. What's the difference?
You don't stick with your own camp. Nobody else is right.
Yeah, okay. Ecumenism basically says, let's all work together. We're all going to the same place. There are many roads that lead to heaven, and I just am on one of them. I don't believe that. Pluralism, though. What does pluralism mean? Yeah, there are many different ways of thinking, and I respect their right to think that way. I just don't agree with them. Okay? There's a difference. Pluralism refers to my tolerance of others as a citizen. Ecumenism refers to my tolerance of others spiritually. I'm intolerant spiritually. I believe the way is very narrow, but I'm pluralistic. Hey, let's do what we've been learning how to do to illustrate this thing of separation for a minute. Separation. Well... separation is to a spiritual leader what sterilization is to a surgeon. In other words, if a surgeon is going to operate on somebody, he has to have a sterile environment. He's got to scrub for a long time and get all of the germs and the bacteria and all of this out of the environment so that when he operates on this person, he won't contaminate him further. Okay? That's what separation is to a preacher. A preacher, he scrubs and he gets all of the filth and the bacteria and the dirt and all the things that would contaminate the people that he's trying to help spiritually. And he gets all of that away from him so that he can help this person. Hey, that's good, isn't it? Do you want the doctor to wash his hands before he operates on you? Do you want the dentist to wash his hands when he walks into the room? Now, dentists have clean hands when they walk into the room. But they've had their hands in somebody else's mouth. Huh? Now, do you want him to wash his hands or don't you? Sure you do. Now, you think he's got a hang up because he washes his hands that much? You think he's trying to tell everybody else that they have dirty hands? No, if he's going to put his hands in your mouth, you want him to have clean hands, don't you? See, that's the same point of separation. A man who's going to teach spiritual truth has to be separated from that which is worldly. And he has to be consistent. Does that help understand that principle a little bit? You see what I'm talking about? You teach something that is unfamiliar and you relate it to something that is familiar. Now that's the law of the lesson. And we're talking about experiences being a series of solved problems. So what you can do if you're trying to teach somebody something that they don't know is relate it to something that they do know and present a problem. Now let's you think of another situation. You think of an illustration of what I'm talking about. Think of a way that we can cause the people that we're trying to teach to relate what we're trying to teach to what they already know by presenting them a problem to solve. Somebody do that. Give me an illustration.
If God, they believe in one.
Okay, the Muslims say that we believe in three gods and they only believe in one.
Use the egg or electricity or the fire.
Okay, use an egg or electricity or fire or something else that has different aspects or water. You know, that it's a solid, it's a liquid, it's a gas, and so on. And you can relate it in that way. I guess water is not a gas. But is it steam? Yeah, I guess so. How about that? Okay. But, okay. All right, somebody give me another one. Present a problem. No. Now, what I want you to do, rather than giving just an illustration, give them a problem that they have to solve. Okay? Now, think with me. Yes?
Sometimes in a tracking. Okay.
Okay, you're talking about man being... All right, now, but again, I appreciate that, Art. Now, what you're doing is you're telling me how this is done. I want you to do this. I don't want you to tell me about others that do it. I want you to do it. I want you to come up with a way of teaching something by presenting a problem to somebody that they have to solve so that they will be able to relate what they're learning to what they already know. Can anybody in here do that? Yes? Okay. I think you shared this with us, okay? That's good. Below zero. All right, so in other words, she related the concept of negative numbers and teaching this to her boys to the thermometer when the thermometer goes below zero. Those are it's -1, -5, something like that. In other words, that way she helped them to understand the concept of negative numbers based on what they could see from the thermometer. Okay, that's a good illustration, yes. Okay, object lessons. That's what you're illustrating is an object lesson here. Did you ever like to learn by object lessons when you were a kid? Did you like object lessons more than any other kind of lesson when you were a kid? I did. Didn't you love that? When somebody used a visual aid or a balloon or a puppet or something like that, something to help you understand what they were talking about. Didn't you like that? Don't you like it when a person uses an illustration or talks about a personal experience instead of just dry, rote lecture, step after step after step? Why? Because it makes it real. Now, let me phrase this one more time, then I'm going to ask get Gary Bailey's comment. What I'm asking you to do is to think in your mind right now about somebody that you're trying to influence. Somebody you're trying to influence for Christ, or one of your children, or some other area in which you're having influence. I want you to think about something that you've been trying to tell somebody, and I want you to think of a way that you can present a problem to them that they have to solve in order to relate this lesson that you're trying to teach to what they already know so that they can learn what you're trying to teach them. Do you understand what I'm asking you? You understand this problem that I'm giving you? Okay? All right. Gary? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. In other words, the dog saw it as a game anyway, and the child saw it as a game, and he played the right game. That's right. That's a good lesson. All right, Hank? Mm-hmm. Okay. You can develop projects to teach your kids. You know, one of the most common ones, I guess we all do it, is if the kids are fighting over who's going to get the biggest piece, present them a little problem. You bring out the knife, don't get the real sharp one, and you give it to one of them and say, okay, you cut. And after you cut, you choose. Okay? You have never seen them cut so close to the middle. See? You give them a problem. Now, here's his little mind. He says, I'm going to cut, and then he's going to choose. Now, if I cut one piece bigger than the other, he's going to pick the big piece. So I'm going to make sure there isn't any big piece. Okay? You see what I'm saying? Isn't that the way they do it? You give them a problem, they solve that problem based on what they already know. It's like, you know, the old the two seagulls. Remember old Red Skelton's thing about the seagulls? Remember that one? Gertrude and Heathcliff, remember that? And they were flying along, and they see the fish down there, so they swoop on down, and Heathcliff grabs the big fish, and Gertrude says, that wasn't very polite. What are you talking about? So, but you took the big fish. So, what would you have done? Said, I'd have taken a small one. He says, you got it. Okay, I saw several hands. I think Dr. Harris was first. That's right. Okay, that's an excellent illustration. He's trying to teach them something that they don't fully understand, so he presents a practical circumstance where they have to make a decision. You see, a lot of people, when they're leading a soul to Christ, never, ever give a person an opportunity to make a decision until they're ready for the big one. No salesman in the world would do that. You don't lead a person through a lecture and then give them an opportunity to make the biggest decision they'll ever make in their life without getting them ready to make a decision. Any salesman knows that you lead a person through a series of decisions. When you're talking about the order form, not contract, okay? Try to make it as desirable. And salesmen know this. Your pen or mine? You got it in your hand, okay? That's something they teach salesmen, okay? Now, in other words, you give them a series of decisions. What is that zip code? Now, if they give you their zip code, what are you going to do with it? Going to write it on the contract. That's what you're going to do. Every little piece of information they give you is a step towards buying what you're selling. Now, that's common sense. That's not manipulation. Well, it may be manipulation if you don't want that thing, okay? But it's common sense to get people in the mood to make a decision. I mean, every salesman knows that if you want him to sell something, you've got to get his head going like this, okay? And you get him doing this, and then finally you come down to the final decision of, do you want this thing? And his head's already going like that, okay? But if the fellow's just sitting there the whole time like this, No salesman in his right mind would ask a man to invest a large amount of money if he hasn't had some opportunity to see whether this man is with him or not. You understand what I'm saying? And the children of this world are wiser sometimes than the children of darkness are wiser than the children of light. We will turn right around, and because we think, well, this is, we're not going to use sales techniques here, but, and therefore we don't use common sense. We don't give a man any opportunity to respond in any step of our presentation of the gospel until finally we ask him, do you want to receive Christ? And we don't even know if he's with us or not. You see what I'm saying? Now, the reason the salesman does that is not just to trick the guy into buying, but he wants to see if he's got him going with him. But he's going to ask to make a big decision later. You see what I'm saying? Ain't that common sense? Over here. Bernie.
Yeah, I've got all things figured
out. You think you know everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me take it a step further. What Bernie is talking about is a problem that you're going to have with people that think. Okay? You get into a community or a society of people that think, that use their minds, and they won't tolerate our absolutism without some justification. They just won't do it. They'll say, well, you think you know everything. What makes you so sure? That's your opinion. You'll hear these kinds of things all the time. My friend Mike Gallagher, every time I witness that guy, he comes up with that stuff. What makes you think you've got all the answers? You know, how come you're so right? And then I have, every time I have to take him right back to that thing of, if there is a God, how can we know anything about God? The only way we can know anything about God, and I got to through that whole process, is if he tells us something. If he doesn't tell us, we don't know anything about him. Now, if he's told us something, how'd he tell us? And I got to go right back to the book, and I got to get back in and use the book as my authority. If I don't establish that with him, every single time I got to go through that argument. Every time. And I learned that the hard way. All right, we got two hands. Let's start here.
How do we involve
bigotry? Okay, all right. I think what we have to do, ecumenism, as Steve has said, is the idea that every opinion or attitude is equally valid, and we're going to remove all divisive beliefs from our public discussions. Well, the problem with that, the reason we can't participate in it is because we know ours is right and theirs is wrong. Ecumenism says, well, I believe mine is right and he believes his is right, and you know, both of us could be right and both of us could be wrong. Anybody with a brain is going to see the contradiction in that. If I believe I'm right, I've got to believe you're wrong if you don't agree with me. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not nice, it just means I'm consistent. Okay? If I'm right, you're wrong unless we agree. So somebody has got to be wrong. And since I believe I'm right, it must be you. Okay? Therefore, I have to reason from that standpoint. Now, I do not come to him with a polemic presentation of I'm right and you're wrong. I come to him with a presentation and I assume and give him the benefit of the doubt that he really wants to know what's right too. Now, if I come like an arrogant know-it-all, then I come with the statement, I'm right and you're wrong. Now, if you really want to know what's right, then abandon what you believe and embrace what I believe. And then if he does so, he's only going to do it on the basis of his trust in me. And I don't want him to trust me. I want him to trust the truth. So what I've got to do is say, since I know I'm right, I'm going to give this man the benefit of the doubt that he has come to his conclusions because of lack of information or lack of thought. And if I can provoke his thought and give him new information, he may come to the same conclusions I've come to. You see what I'm saying? That's fair-minded, reasonable debate. And I think we need to do that. So the right way to do it is to go ahead and assume we're right, they're wrong. Now, on the fundamentals, okay? Now, on the other things that are not fundamentals, that are open to discussion or interpretation, I think we have to be extremely careful about the I'm right, you're wrong attitude. I believe this is right. Now, we can be pluralistic, okay, on the non-fundamentals. But on the fundamentals, they are absolute. But we don't have to be absolute in our presentation of them. Now, we're never going to get through this outline if we keep this up, but that's okay. Go ahead. We've got to understand that everybody's not at the same place. Two people may be going in the same direction, but not be at the same place. You see? And we've got to distinguish between a person's direction or destination and a person's location at the moment. If a guy's going to the right place, we need to be tolerant and patient with him. Understand that? He may not be there yet. If a man is headed in the right place, we ought not to condemn him. You know, that's one of the things that irritates the life out of me about some of my brethren. I mean, it really irritates me when I haven't had an opportunity to learn something yet and they're judging me and acting like I know all the facts and I've chosen the wrong ones. And I have fundamental brethren that act that way regularly. Maybe you do too. That's an extremely frustrating experience. Now, if you know how much it frustrates us when we are committed to wanting to do right and trying to learn the truth, and somebody else comes up. I mean, you know, you raise your hand. Hey, what about this lordship salvation thing? Can you explain that to me? Well, I'll tell you, you believe that. You just, you know, and they just jump right down your throat. Isn't that ridiculous? A guy called me up on the phone yesterday. You know, I saw your little tract here. What do you believe about repentance? Well, you know, define your terms. First off, who are you? Okay. Are you a Christian? Well, of course. Well, I don't even know who you are. All right, I told him what I believe about repentance. Well, what do you believe about Curtis Hudson, blah, blah, blah. And I felt like saying, look, why don't you call Curtis Hudson? You want to know what he believes? I don't know what he believes. I haven't read that book. Well, you know, he's got another little book here, Lordship Salvation. What do you think about that? I said, well, in the first place, I don't think he's talking about Lordship Salvation. I think he's talking about sinless perfection. But I know more about that than I understand. I don't believe a lot of what I know. What do you believe? Okay, I just threw it back at him. And I thought, good night. What is this guy? What is he? What is he want to go beat somebody up and quote me? Or is he trying to beat me up? I didn't know what he was trying to do, you know. But this guy just got me all confused and everything, and I hope I confused him too. But the point is sometimes people just get so belligerent about stuff and they assume that you know everything about everything and that you've picked the wrong one. You know what I mean?
And on purpose.
You know, oh yeah, who does that? Who uses that phrase all the time? He did that on purpose. Who does that? Little kids. Any mistake you make, it's on purpose. If he hit me, he hit me as hard as he could. You know, isn't that right? They always have to qualify. Isn't that right? Isn't that the way kids talk? They always get extreme. Now, that kind of absolute behavior is wrong and offensive and childish, and we need to be careful about avoiding that kind of thing. Okay, I'll tell you what. You know, probably the way we ought to do this lesson is I ought to just teach these things for 3 or 4 weeks and let Art come in and get the outline caught up. What you think? Okay, go ahead, Hank. Mm-hmm. Yeah, make it clear. That's good. Get out of the way. All right. Very important sense, what we call knowledge is a record to solve problems. Real quick. This law of knowledge thus explains, affords to the thoughtful teacher rules of the highest practical value. Now, this is a review. What we've talked about last week and this week concerning the law of the lesson is summed up in some things to do and not do. Okay? Number one, find out what your pupils know of the subject you wish to teach them. This is your starting point. That's what most people don't do when they try to teach their kids something or when they try to teach a lost person about Christ. They don't have any idea where that person is or what they know or what they don't know. Isn't that right? Why is that? Don't want to take the time? Maybe don't have the time? Maybe don't feel like we have the time? Did you know that it takes us more time to do it the wrong way than it would to do it the right way? How come you never have time to do it right, but you always find time to do it over? Huh? Isn't that right? If you don't have time to do it right, you'll have to find time to do it over. Isn't that right? So you might as well take time to do it right. Because you're going to have to find time to do it over. Okay? Make the most of the pupils' knowledge and experience. Make the most of their knowledge and experience. Encourage your pupils to clear up and freshen their knowledge by a clear statement. If you can ever get them to say it, you've made tremendous progress. You've heard me say this a number of times. If you can't say it, you might as well not know it. If you can't state it clearly, you might as well not know it. Is that fair? I think so. If you can't put it into words, well, you know, I know it, I just can't put it into words. Not doing you any good then, is it? Might as well not know it. Okay. Good. We don't have time to go too much further with this today. Let me just leave you with this thought. Let's suppose that you're trying to teach a child something, or an adult something for that matter, and you start asking them questions. Now, you know, this happens in Sunday school all the time, frankly. You can't get frustrated about it. You got to realize what's going on. You ask them a question, and you can't get an answer. So you press them. You press them. And they come up with an answer, and it's not the right one. So you ask them another question, and they come up with another. And after a while, you figure they're guessing. And they've guessed two or three times, and they haven't guessed the right answer yet. And so you say, no, now think with me. And then they give you this, well, what's the point attitude. I don't know. What are you getting at? What are they telling you? They may be telling you they don't understand. That's a possibility, but I think it may be something else. Huh? They don't care. Okay, so where are you? What do you not have from that learner? Attention. He is not attending with interest. Now, a lot of people try to solve the law of the learner in the law of the lesson, and that ain't going to happen. You understand how that works? You cannot cause that learner to attend with interest to something about which they do not care. You got to go back to the law of the learner and give them something that they're interested in or something that they care about to get their attention. And it may be a 2x4 that you have to use. Now, see, these people don't care at all about what I'm saying. Okay? Okay? They're leaving. Okay. No, that's the choir. They're going to be in the choir. You got to learn to relate to them. And they're like, I got to tell you this one. We live in the electronic age, right? The other day I was talking to Joseph, little Joe. Now, bless Joe's heart. He's the baby of the family. And I shouldn't even say he's the baby of the family because, you know, he doesn't want to be a baby. And I tease him sometimes, like, come here, you little runt. You know, like that. And the other day, I realized that hurts his feelings. Oh, my. He was just sitting there, and he was all mopey and everything like that. And I said, what's the matter? You know, he says, my whole life is just down. He says like that. And I said, what's the matter, Joe? I'm just a runt. I said, hey, you're not a runt. Come here. And I pulled him in there, and I talked to him for a few minutes. And I realized that some of this little teasing, little loving things that we've been saying to him have been hurting his feelings. I said, what do you want to do? He says, now notice this. You got to understand the culture in which we live. He says, I want to just fast forward my life. I knew immediately what he was talking about. I said, well, hey, let's rewind this whole thing here. Okay, and we'll start this over. You got to find a way to communicate with them where they're thinking, okay? All right, let's stand.